This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. If you need any more information, head to FUBARradio.com.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Oh, well done. Do you know what? We took that right up to the line.
We did.
Didn't we?
I only just put my headphones
literally, on. Natalie has been fucking around with the database. I think it's pronounced data. And literally, I wanted a specific song from Alice Cooper that they failed to upload onto the database, and moments to spare, and I mean moments. I'm literally, by a moment I mean seconds.
Yeah. How long is a moment?
A moment I would say is a second. So seconds to spare, and we didn't have any to spare. In fact, I'd put my earmuffs on. My finger was hovering over the jingle button.
Yeah.
Is it a jingle? It's an ident. It's an ident. The ident button, jingle button, sounds like the sort of thing that Santa would have on his sleigh. The ident button, and you don't need to know what goes on behind the scenes, guys.
Luckily for everyone out there, we're probably not going to need it for about half an hour.
No, absolutely. but literally, the clock was saying we've got 2 seconds left. It was like watching Bond dismantle a bomb. It was absolutely textbook. Anyway, Natalie managed to put the song on 2 seconds to spare, and just as I pressed on the ident, the door closed shut, her leaving the studio, so that we can. Get on with producing another week of excellent content. Now on Spotify, Nat.
Yeah, we're on Spotify.
So make sure that when you're having your party and all of your guests have come along and they've uploaded their songs, make sure that you leave enough time so that you can just, when it's on shuffle, play a whole 2 hours of Fan Club. There are some songs. Are the songs on Spotify? The songs aren't on
Spotify.
Which episode
would you recommend for a good party?
The one for a good party. The trouble is, I'm so egocentric, I'm struggling to remember any of the guests. who have we had on? Who would you recommend?
Who would have a party atmosphere?
Joel Dommett, probably.
Joel Dommett,
Get Joel
the Joel Dommett episode.
Episode one. Start with episode one, Joel Dommett.
Yeah.
And work your way backwards to before we were airing. What a week.
What a week it's been, eh?
What a week it's been. What a week. Has it only been a week, Nat?
It has only been a week.
So we're on Spotify, and we've had a lot of... there's a lot of people out there that are actually listening to this show and thinking, do you know what? I'll go on iTunes and give it a review. And what they've been doing with that is they've been giving it a 5-star review. But not leaving a comment. If you do, and I wouldn't ask for that. I think it's beneath us. I think it's tacky. It's the sort of thing Brett Goldstein would do on his podcast. But I imagine there are other people that do it on their podcasts. But
we don't.
Hit the like button and subscribe. but I am
mattresses.com. That's the again podcast. Lots of mattress adverts.
Hey, this is a whole new way of delivering food.
Straight to your mouth.
I just click an app, and a man turns up on my doorstep and shoves it right in my mouth. Doorstep. Doorstep food. It's a whole new way of fucking. The sort of thing that you had to be sponsored by.
Yes. Have we got a sponsor?
No, I think our fans are our sponsors. That's Fan Club.
Yeah, that's Fan Club.
Our fans have given us our mugs.
Yes, we have a lovely mug. I noticed as well, because they asked, it is still that same mug, but last week I think we were going to be promised official FUBAR mugs.
Yeah, they said, oh look,
if
it only takes like 1 or 2 weeks for a fan to make a mug for us.
Yeah, yeah.
then
I'm sure they could turn it around
in a couple of days, the whole of FUBAR. But no, still, they have been ordered. Yeah, but they're not fucking here, are they? And to be fair, I don't even use a mug. So we're only looking for one mug that has Nat on it. You haven't even had the decency of getting a Sharpie and just writing it on a white mug. I think I'm absolutely horrified by what's going on behind the scenes here. But, you know, keep it light.
Keep it light.
So if you punch the subscribe button, hit that like, and ring that bell for notifications. Yes. If we were on YouTube, but we're not. Thanks for listening. They mug us, they feed us, and they clothe us.
They don't mug us off,
and they don't, you know.
They mug us on.
Ooh, I don't like this. I don't like this at all. Watch this face. What's this face?
We're having faces pulled at us through the window.
So anyway, another week, another word has left my brain. But that's what happens.
It's been a busy week for you, though, Nick, isn't it?
I have had a very busy week.
You've done your show, your Halloween show at the Pleasance. I saw it on Saturday. It's very good. I loved it.
Yeah?
I loved it.
Yeah, I remember when I went to see your show, I unprompted talked about it for 15 minutes.
Okay.
Sure.
So it starts.
What I like about this show is that you're kind of like, you the listeners, are sort of like growing with us, aren't you? So all this year, we went through you writing your show and putting your show together and then doing Edinburgh all the way to the eventual point of me seeing it and giving you my opinion. And then we
moved on.
That's
the end point, wasn't it,
then
of the show, really?
Then we moved on. And we never mentioned it again because I finally gave it the thumbs up.
Yeah, at the end of the film of that show,
yeah.
It would be you telling me about it on the radio.
That's the freeze frame. No, it wouldn't even be the freeze frame. The freeze frame would be you doing the show and then it would fade to black and then there'd be a photo of me, the real me, not the actor that plays me. Who could that be?
Who would play you in a film?
Yeah, Tom Hardy.
Yeah, okay, we'll have Tom Hardy, he's there.
Tom Hardy.
And there'll be a freeze, perhaps a succession of Polaroids, like a National Lampoon's Vacation movie or something, with a song playing over it.
Yeah, sure, but not National Lampoon's, because that would mean that I would be murdered in Vietnam by my own troops. Tom Hardy has been me,
yeah.
Right? And then at the end, it would be a freeze frame, and then the real me would turn up.
Yeah.
And it would just be like a Polaroid of me, you know, saying something positive, right? The freeze frame would be me clapping, I think, in the audience of your show.
Yeah.
So the film is all about your show, but the final freeze frame would be me, Tom Hardy, clapping the show on my own, looking around me as if, why aren't more people clapping?
Why is no one else clapping?
And then there'd be a Polaroid of me, the real me, Nick Helm, and next to it there'd be a caption saying, that week, Nick Helm... the real
killed in Vietnam
by his own troops.
There's a bit that is a sort of, that ending of I like the ending of Animal House, but that bit at the end when it does, it is always a bit
really dark.
It's gone a bit bleak.
Yeah, but that's how I feel about Old School.
I haven't seen Old School.
Old School, it's like. So you got Vince. This is a massive spoiler for Old School.
I've not seen it.
It's got Will Ferrell, Vince Vaughn, and Luke Wilson go back to college, right? And when they go back to college, the guys that they used to bully when they were at college, because they were bullies, right? Mm-hmm. The guy that they used to bully is Jeremy Piven, right? Mm-hmm. And he has become a dean, right? And he's the real joy killer. And he goes around stopping all of their fun, right? Which is basically all of their fun is sleeping with underage women and having frat parties, right? And that's what the dean is basically trying to stop. And they used to bully him, right? They bullied him to the point that he's all fucked up, right? And that's what most of the film is about. And then also Luke Wilson fancies a woman who's got a boyfriend who cheats on her. And then the film finishes and everyone's like, hey, that's great. And then there's this extra bit at the end of the film where the... Oi, I'm over here. Where, stop tweeting, stop writing, right? And then the end of the film is that you've got the boyfriend who's been cheating on the main love interest in the film. He's driving his car down the road and he's listening to Whitesnake, Here I Go Again On My Own. And Jeremy Piven is fly fishing in a lake or in a river. And the guy, I think his cigarette drops out of his mouth or something, and he goes to pick it up. He loses control of his car. He goes off a bridge, lands on Jeremy Piven, and he explodes and dies. And you go, Jeremy,
it's a bit much.
It leaves such a horrible taste in your mouth, where you go, they bullied him and he dies in a horrible fiery explosion.
It should be like one of them slips over some dog shit or something and be like, oh, you.
Yeah, right.
That's sort of the revenge of it. They kind of die. Like,
it's just this really horrible fiery.
And then you cut to like Jeremy Piven's mum and the coroner saying, I don't think you want to see him.
I mean, logically, that's how it really should end. It's like horrible. Just
seems escalating.
I almost like old school, and then every time I think, because I love Luke Wilson.
I love Luke Wilson.
I love Owen Wilson and Luke Wilson. Mm. Owen Wilson for his brains and his heart, and Luke Wilson for his face and his shoulders. I love those Wilson boys. And Andrew Wilson is... I don't love Andrew Wilson.
I don't know Andrew Wilson.
Andrew Wilson is their third brother who works on the art department of a lot of films, and he is also... I think he is one of Hansel's trainers in Zoolander when they're doing the dance-off, and he's also... he's the coach in Rushmore.
Right, okay, that's nice.
So you would know him if you've seen him. I think I think he's in Idiocracy as well. But he's in a few of their films. It's not him. I love Luke Wilson. I will watch anything with Luke Wilson in. We've done 11 minutes and we've still not talked about anything that we've done.
I'll tell you what else we haven't done. This is Fan Club.
Hello, my name's Nick Helm.
And my name's Nathaniel Metcalf.
And you're listening to Fan Club. First rule of Fan Club is...
tell your friends about Fan Club.
Second rule of Fan Club is, please, for the love of God, tell your friends. Yeah, and punch that like button, hit that subscribe. We're now on Spotify, put us on shuffle, have a dance.
So, put your dancing shoes on and put on Fan Club.
Put on 2 hours of chat. Don't worry, it's actually probably more like an hour and 45 minutes because the songs have been cut.
Yes.
What have you been up to this week?
Well, I have been on Halloween Day itself.
Oh, it's been Halloween this week.
Halloween.
I love Halloween. You came to see I Think You Stink. You were just about to tell me how great it was.
It was great. I came to see your show, I Think You Stink, and I thought it was excellent, Nick. And I had all kinds of ideas and moments while I was in there. I thought you were brilliant. Yes. I thought the cast was brilliant.
Yes.
And I thought they were all stars in the making.
Yes.
And I think it's, as I was saying to you, I think it's sort of a telling that when people come see a show, which is like a Nick Helm presents, not like Wes Craven presents, very much Nick Helm at the forefront, but I thought you were quite generous with other people, and you give everyone has their own song and their own moment to shine.
Yes.
And they do shine. That's what I thought. Yeah. And I thought, well, it must be a difficult thing to do because people aren't there to see this. There, see you. Yours is the name on the billboard. Mm. And yeah, I thought it was nice that these people got these big moments.
Yes. Yes, and the other thing is I wrote it and directed it, so I'm all over it. That's all I want in that. Now, what have you been up to this year? Thank you for hitting my subscribe button. What have you been up to? Halloween week,
I do for Halloween, which I've done for the past 3 years, is I'm a big Hammer horror fan, but there's loads of Hammer films, right? Loads of them. And I'm very familiar, have been since I was a kid, with all the big ones, and I've watched lots of them. So now I'll take it upon myself to try and watch a Hammer horror movie that I've never seen before.
Right.
So this year I watched one called The Kiss of the Vampire, which is very good.
Who's in that?
It's not one with any of the big stars. It's very starlight, but it's a very lush, sort of early expensive, one of the Universal Hammers. So it's
I didn't know Universal did Hammer.
They did they were the kind of people that sort of saved Universal. Universal were having done the sort of monster cycle.
Universal did the monsters. I always thought that Hammer was like a British answer to the American monsters.
It was, but they did, after they did Curse of Frankenstein, which is the first Hammer Frankenstein, the first sort of proper Hammer horror, gothic horror.
And they started off big budget, did they? And then they sort of declined.
No, they started off quite low. They're always quite low budget. but they sort of use their budgets very well in the early days, especially, or they really, they're all filmed in this one big house called Bray Studios, which is like this big house right. in the late 50s and early 60s. And they just redress all the rooms in this house. For all the early Hammers are all, they're all basically, all the sets are the same. You right. can see the same sort of living rooms and the same. So you use this big kind of country house to film them all in, but they just redress them for every film.
Oh, wow.
But so they're really nice and they're quite familiar and cozy in a funny way, yeah. except they're all like, this time it's Dracula's hallway, or this sure, time it's right. like...
I've never really got into Hammer. I mean, I've bought a box set recently and I'm like forcing myself, but it feels like the Universal Monsters, I just find like... That's easy.
Yeah, yeah.
They're so beautiful to look at, and I love all the black and white stuff, and I just think, yeah. And I think that they're so iconic as well. And I get real, a real sense of excitement seeing stuff like The Wolfman, and you go, oh, this is, oh, it's brilliant. And it's so, like, classic and ingrained in cinema. You know, like, I watched a John Landis film this week that I'll talk about, but there's all these clips from kind of, like... Dracula, and there was like Hammer clips as well in I watched Innocent Blood.
Oh, I don't know that.
So he puts loads of clips from also American Werewolf in London. You know, he had like Wolfman yeah, yeah. clips and stuff like that. And I love those films. But with Hammer, I always found I don't like the look of the blood. It looks like poster paint, and I just think and some of it's really like you know like the special effects at the end of the original Evil Dead.
Yes, yeah.
And it's really like icky. Like, it makes you feel sick.
Well, that's it. I think the
Dracula effects, when he gets killed, are, like, they make me feel sick.
Well, I think that's kind of it. That they're supposed... Certainly at the time, they were sort of super gory. That was way beyond what anyone else was doing.
Yeah.
And the idea that they were... Essentially, the big thing they did was put them in colour. So a lot of the... At the time, Hammer was also making lots of dramas, or sort of psychological dramas, and they're in black and white because they're meant to be... The black and white for Hammer almost represents real life. Whereas the colour ones are meant to represent a sort of super unreal, and so the reds are super red to the point where they're not even red, they're like orange or
yeah right.
So they're meant to look almost sickly and gory and over the top, but now I think they look quite quaint in comparison with lots of other things because they're because so much else has come since. So now they look quite classic. Except they've got this kind of gore in them, or what would be considered gore then, but was just blood.
No, but I think that they are gory, but they're gory in like when Dracula's hand is decomposing, and yes. it's just like ugh,
yeah,
you know. And I'm like a double R bastard.
Mm.
Still can't bring myself to watch the Hostel movies, but who can?
Building up to it.
No, I don't think I think I might live my life without seeing them.
Well, that's it, because I feel like I really like horror movies, but what I actually like, I really like that kind of classical era more than anything.
That's what I find so fucking frustrating about the Mummy remake, but also the Brendan Fraser Mummy films, where they were just like, we won't make a horror film. It's just like, do you know what? Even the original Mummy wasn't that great. The Boris Karloff yes. one. It wasn't that great. It was like the sequels... They learnt from the sequels what it was. He's only a mummy for like 30 seconds at the beginning of the film, and then the rest of it, he's Boris Karloff with the like aging makeup. Mm. And you kind of like go, this film as a horror film is ripe for a big budget horror remake. Mm-hmm. And it's like when they did Dracula Untold.
Oh, yeah.
It's like they've made it into an action film. You go, just make a horror, just make an actual. I mean, you go, oh, what, another remake of Dracula? It's just like, yeah, but even Francis Ford Coppola's, at least he was trying to make a horror film, but he made like this art house weird film. Just do it once, right, and then we'll move on. And the reason why you keep having to remake these films is because you keep fucking them up and not doing them. And so, like, so when you look at all of the original Universals, probably don't remake Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein because they absolutely nailed it with those ones. And it's so iconic that there'll never be another Frankenstein design that will beat the original Boris Karloff one. And then, but Dracula, loads of room for improvement on that. Although the performance, Bela Lugosi's performance of that was like classic. And I think that's why probably Hammer Christopher Lee did so well with the part.
He just does it completely different.
Because he does it completely different, but also he's equally as iconic as Bela Lugosi. And then you look at, and I guess that's why their Mummy films were so big as well, with Christopher Lee being the Mummy, where you go, yeah, because the Mummy original ones were rubbish. So when they do the Tom Cruise one, and it's not a horror film. It's an action adventure romp, and you just a comedy romp, and you go like, why have you done this?
Well, I think that's, I'm sure we talked about it before, but that's the problem with that Dark Universe thing, was that they start this universe where they're going to use these universal horror characters, but what they're trying to do is Marvel. Yeah. They're trying to do Marvel movies in a shared universe, so they make these horror icons into sort of superheroes.
Yeah.
So he's not a mummy, he's sort of got powers of a mummy, but he's sort of a good guy. Yeah. That sort of,
that's how they set it up by the end. And yeah. You're just like, I don't want to watch that.
Yeah.
And why has the mummy got four pupils in per eye? Or whatever? Do you know what I mean? It's just like, what's that got to do with anything? It's like they threw special effects in places where you didn't need it. And then you just, oh, it's rubbish. And then the Brendan Fraser ones, I mean, I really enjoyed the first one when I saw it at the cinema. But it's Indiana Jones.
It's Indiana Jones, yeah.
And you go, do you know what would be really good? Indiana Jones with horror. Horror Indiana Jones. But they didn't do that. They did Indiana Jones with a completely sort of like, it was, there was no fear and jeopardy or anything in the whole film.
But there was also that stuff in the 80s, you did have that sort of PG-13 horror. You see, you have like Gremlins and Poltergeist and those kind of things.
Gremlins where they're genuinely fucking scary.
Yeah, so
and
you can do it.
Poltergeist is fucking scary.
You can do a sort of a big sort of a horror franchise which is for all ages. It just doesn't have to be, you know, I guess a little bit toned down, gory or... You know, you do get those things. Like, there's certain shock moments in lots of those kind of PG-80s movies.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel like you couldn't do something similar now.
I guess they tried to do that with It. Did you see it?
No, I didn't see it.
It was... But the thing that they did with It was just kind of like... They were all... it was almost really scary. But they would fuck it up at the last... I know, I'm still finding it so surprising with how scary people find... The last one that they made, because you go, there's a bit when they're watching a projector, they're watching the clown, they're projecting an old home movie on a wall, and it's a woman and her hair is blowing, and it's black and white, and it's all like going, it's like a flicker book, right? So it's like flick 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 flick, and her hair is blown across her face, and then every so often you see like a tiny little glimpse of under the hair, it's actually the clown's face, and it's like, oh, that's creepy. And then it is the clown, the clown is on the screen, and then the clown comes out of the screen, and he's a 50-foot clown that's like coming out of the screen. It's all CGI, and you go, whoa. It was really scary when there were like glimpses of it, but now... You've shown the clown. It's all about the... We all know what the clown looks like. It's the clown for the whole thing. If you there's a bit where they're flicking through a book and then you think you've glimpsed a picture of the clown and you go, have I just seen that? And then they just show you the picture and you go, yeah, I did just see that. That's what I did see, yeah. And it's kind of like... It was almost good. It was almost scary. And then it was heavy-handed. Mm. And it's kind of like... And I find it really weird in that film as well where... they did a Strange Things with it, because we've obviously got the same nostalgia for the 80s as in the 80s they had for the 50s, and so the Stranger Things they do with it, I think the opening shot is he's got like the kid's got like a Gremlins poster and a Beetlejuice poster on his wall, and then at the cinema they're showing Nightmare on Elm Street 3, and you go, yeah, Nightmare on Elm Street 3 about a dream monster that goes around killing the young. Yeah, that's basically what Stephen King stole it off. He was just off his face on coke, and he went, Freddy Krueger, I'll do one of them. And then he wrote, a 9,000-page book off his face in the 80s. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've gone back and I've watched the Tim Curry yet, and you go, yeah, that's... Tim Curry is great in it, and the rest of the film is not good.
It feels like it's almost like it. I preferred that first half of it when they're kids, and when they get to adults, they just think they're all like kind of bad wigs and things, isn't it?
Yeah, but it is. It flashes back and forward, I think.
I thought the first episode is almost like you get most of it's just flashback, isn't it?
I think the book is the book flashes back and forward, and. But that's what was weird about the remake, when they've split it in half and they've gone, yeah, but it's they've done the kids now and now they're going to do the adults. And actually what happens is they flick back and forward. And so the second half, you haven't got like the kids to kind of like rely on.
Having not seen this remake, but I can understand when you're saying about something comes up and it's 50 foot high, that automatically would take me out of it and be like...
It's just like something comes out of a painting. You go, oh, and then you go, oh, it's just a CGI. Like all of the threats are CGI clearly CGI.
Yeah.
And you go, well, they're not even in the same room as a thing. Yeah. Whereas if you kind of like glimpse like Christopher Lee's hand, you know, through a series of dissolves, like visual dissolves, where they're kind of like replacing his real hand for kind of like a prop hand that melts and stuff.
The bit like. I like about that.
I mean,
that
that's
scene.
Real though. Yeah. And you're watching that, and that has an actual effect on me where I feel. Ugh.
I think what makes that a bit horrible is the fact you see his hand dissolve to the fact where it's bone, and then it cuts back to his face, which is still Christopher Lee's face, which is suggesting that he's experiencing this thing with his hand.
Yeah.
Essentially melting and dissolving.
Yeah, it's horrible. So I watched Innocent Blood this week.
I don't know Innocent Blood.
Oh, I've seen it. I watched it one New Year's Eve. I didn't get invited out by any of my friends. And I went to Blockbuster and I watched... my family went out as well. So I was basically...
Home Alone.
I was home alone. And I watched Fright Night 2 and Innocent Blood. This was 2017.
He's Innocent Blood. Seems reasonable to me. Seems plausible.
You didn't even bat an eyelid.
It's entirely plausible.
It was, I think it was like 1995, 96. And I watched Innocent Blood and Fright Night 2. Fright Night 2, terrible film. Innocent Blood, I haven't seen it since then. It's got this fucking theme tune, though. It's got this piece of music that I've been singing in my head for, 20 mm-hmm. years? It's just like... Innocent Blood is basically a John Landis horror comedy. But it's not... I don't think it's very funny. But it's like a John Landis horror comedy where he's sort of attempting to do the same thing for for vampires as what he did for werewolves with American Werewolf in London.
Oh, and is it from 95? Is it a mid-90s film?
I think it was 91. It's got the... 91, 92. It's got the woman from... oh, I can't remember what nice too. Well, what's the lead actress called? She was in Nikita.
Bridget Fonda.
Anne Parelaud.
Oh, the
French. Original, the actual lead best song. Stop talking to us, please. Listeners, we've got a lot of noise going on in our headphones. So it's got Anne Parelaud in it, and it's got, this is my favourite, it's got Anthony LaPaglia and Robert Loggia. And so LaPaglia and Loggia.
This film has absolutely passed me by. What a weird thing.
Robert Loggia... So basically what it is the new... when it got released overseas, they changed the name to A French Vampire in America.
Right, OK.
And apparently John Landis got really pissed off. But it's got, like, cameos. It's got cameos from Sam Raimi, Frank Oz, and fucking Dario Argento.
Right. Oh, wow.
And it was just like, there's this bit when Dario Argento's there, and I'm just like going, that's Dario Argento. And the theme tune, so basically it's set in America. There's a French vampire that's this beautiful, and she's good. She's a good vampire, and she's beautiful. And she only preys on bad people. And there's all the mafia and all these gangsters, and it starts off and it's really kind of violent and unpleasant, and Robert Loggia or Loggia is the I always think it's funny, Anthony LaPaglia and Robert Loggia, and it's like we've got Roy Scheider, Rod Steiger, and Rob Schneider in Too Many Ciders. It's like you got Steiger, Scheider, and Snyder together at last with Maria Shriver. So you got Robert Loggia and Anthony LaPaglia in Innocent Blood. And so it was... So we were watching fucking... So... She accidentally, she tries to kill Robert Loggia by biting his neck. And he's like the nice guy. He's like the old guy in Big.
Yeah, I know him.
He does the piano dance. I fucking love that guy. And he's so good in this film. And basically he becomes a vampire. And the plot, and Don Rickles is in it as his kind of like money guy. And Don Rickles has this amazing death. And basically Robert Loggia goes around... biting all the rest of his mafia lot, and they become like vampire gangsters. It's a really cool film. There's some really good bits in it. It's not perfect, and it's obviously nowhere near as good as American Werewolf in London, but it's kind of like, it's much better than Vampire in Brooklyn.
How's it compared to Memoirs of the Invisible Man?
Memoirs of the Invisible Man, I've never sat all the way through. I can't. But that's
Carpenter, isn't it?
That's John Carpenter. Yeah. It's not a good film. But this is great, and it's got a really unique look for all the vampires, and when they burn up and die, it's just incredible. It's just like, I've got it on Blu-ray.
Is it meant to be quite comic as well? Is it meant to be quite funny?
I think it's meant, there are like, it's subtle humour, and I would say that in American Werewolf in London, when it's funny, it's funny, and when it's not, it's scary. Yeah. And when it's scary, it's scary. But with this, it's kind of like, it's not a perfect film, and it's not particularly funny, but there is kind of like a light air to it.
Yeah, it'd be,
but then when it's violent, it's really fucking violent, and and it's got some real good gore effects and stuff in it. So that was Innocent.
So it's probably what John Landis made like after coming to America then or something.
Yeah, it would have been around that time.
Wow.
So 1992. He would have done it what, just before The Stupids,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Like. And several years before Blues Brothers.
He's really trod that ground, doesn't he, then, between horror and comedy?
Well, he was trying to get he did Thriller.
Yeah, of course.
And he worked with Rick Baker, and he's famous for, like, doing iconic films, really, John Landis is. I mean, he did Animal House, mm-hmm. and he did American Werewolf in London, he did Blues Brothers, and they're all very, you know, each of those films were iconic for their own things.
Yeah.
And then he did Thriller, and, yeah, he's... I think he's really underrated. I saw him talk at the BFI. He's like one of them people that like had just had hit after hit after hit. And then also Eddie Murphy coming to America.
Yeah.
And then Beverly Hills Cop 3, which we don't talk about. But I really liked Beverly Hills Cop 3 when it first came out. I saw him do a talk at the BFI, and he was just fascinating.
Time I see him interviewed, I like him a lot.
He loves horror. He's got an amazing sense of humour, and he brought out a book called Monsters, and it's just a really good book that sits on my bookshelf unopened. He's just as famous for horror as comedy, really, which is an interesting kind of like thing to bridge. Innocent Blood's a really good film. Anyway, the theme tune just goes, I watched a documentary about how John Williams does music scores this week, and he uses themes, and what I really, you know, he obviously he uses themes, but what's amazing about John Williams' Star Wars scores is that each character has a different thing, and when there's multiple characters on screen, he does like blends of all of their themes, and then you have like stuff like Jewel of Fates. But then you listen to that, you look at the twin sons, Luke looking at the twin sons on Tatooine in that first film, and then you take the music out of it, and you go, oh my god, it brings so much emotion to it. And then when you listen to Innocent Blood, it's basically got this bit that goes. And you go, yeah. And they play it over and over again for the entire film, and that is the score. And you go, it's a totally different approach to it, where you've got like, we've basically got a theme, we've got a little bit of a theme there, and we're just going to repeat it over and over again. And you get that so much with these. And also looking at John Carpenter, I mean, this week I watched Escape from LA, The Ward, and Ghosts of Mars. All awful. I mean, talk about how much I love, or we love, John Carpenter. Those three are fucking terrible films. The Ward was like his last film.
I haven't seen The Ward.
It was the least bad of the lot, actually.
Okay.
But Ghosts of Mars is fucking unwatchable.
I don't know. I've got. It's all right. It's all right, Ghosts of Mars.
Well, now, even because Matthew Holness was talking about it last week, and how and even if you're looking at it from the point of view that there's loads of the lost trades and arts of cinema, where you've got like miniatures and models and sets and costumes, mm-hmm. and makeup and all of that, and now it would just be special. Even when you're looking at that, that gets old pretty fucking fast. It's a fucking atrocious film.
It's a matriarchy in that film, isn't it? It's meant to be that it's sort of subtly done, but it's meant to be that the women are kind of are sort of in charge, and that the male character kind of secondary.
Natasha Henstridge, she's she really. I mean, it's not that subtle. She's really like the person in charge, and then Ice Cube's kind of like her sidekick and all that. It's just another remake of Rio Bravo, where he's done Assault from Police in 13. He did
Prince of Darkness, I suppose.
He did The Thing. The thing isn't really, but his guy's locked up. But it's like a thing that he kind of like he comes back to over and over again. And then he's done Ghosts of Mars, and then an Escape from LA is fucking it's awful. And the only bit I really liked about it was the basketball scene, and I watched that and it's shit. And the ward starts off okay, and you think this could be all right.
Is it more traditional horror? Does it feel like
the ward? It feels like it doesn't feel like it feels like anyone could have made it.
That's what I wondered. Yeah,
and it sort of like falls apart, and there's too much CGI and stuff in it at the end. But you look at a John Carpenter theme, and that is like he's written a theme tune, and then he repeats it over and over again in the film. And it's not kind of when you look, and I love John Carpenter, but when you compare John Carpenter to John Williams, it's kind of like there's no John Williams is doing a completely different thing.
I was going to say, isn't John Williams, didn't he say that the Superman theme came about because it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Superman?
Yeah, I imagine that's right.
So they just come in like, that's how they start. They go, what's it called? They go, Star Wars. You go, Star Wars.
Nothing but Star Wars. And then there's also Alan Silvestri, and you go, back to the future. Predator.
That's how they all work.
That's how they all work. So I went to see the new Halloween film on my Halloween day. I went to see it by myself.
Were you scared? Spooked?
Yeah, I thought it was really fucking scary. And John Williams does the score on that, and he's expanded on it.
John Carpenter
does the score on that. Imagine John Williams doing Halloween. I've done it.
Nailed it.
So, John Carpenter's score on that is really good. The film, I thought it was good. I enjoyed it as much as, and I think I went to see Halloween H2O on Halloween 20 years ago.
God, that's terrifying.
Fucking terrifying, right?
What do you mean 20 years ago?
I was 17, and my sister was at John Moores University in Liverpool, and I went up to visit her for a birthday, and then we went to the cinema, see H2O in the day, and then we had a party in the evening. Do it in the day. Get the film out of the way in the day.
Less scary.
Then have a party in the evening. Because you come out of the cinema, you go home to your empty flat that's filled with shadows, and... there's a masked knife wielding maniac behind every column. I've got some columns in my flat. A couple of columns.
The nice thing about kids now with parties is they can put on the Spotify, slap on a bit of Fan Club for 2 hours, and it gets the party going.
Yeah, maybe
we didn't have that 20 years ago.
Maybe the ultimate Monster Mash mega mix would be something like Thriller.
Yeah.
2 hours of Fan Club, and then the Monster Mash.
Lovely stuff.
Lovely.
That's your Halloween party
and of course,
sorted.
David Essex's cover version of Ghostbusters.
Of course, to end.
I think I've been slimed.
Yep.
Yep. It's like John Kearns doing it. Yep. I thought it was really good. I thought it was really scary. It was scary in the right places. It was brutal in the right places. Michael Myers is fucking terrifying again. I thought what they did really well was all of the victims have at least one moment that humanises them and gives them a moment of levity where you go, oh, I like that guy. Mm. And then all of a sudden, you know, they get killed. And everyone gets that. And there's some really weird characters that you wouldn't get in a slasher film. Like there's a dad and he's making like breakfast or he's making his lunch or something, and he goes, "Oh, I got peanut butter on my penis," because he gets it down the front of his pants, right, and his trousers, sorry, and you go, "Well, where did that come from?" And it's just like this funny little moment where you've got this silly man that's in this film, and he's likable, but it's sort of like you go, "Yeah, I know Dad's like that," Yeah, I just think it's. I just
isn't it Danny McBride?
Danny McBride wrote it with two other people, but the director David Gordon Green.
Yes.
Didn't they do Your Highness?
Yes, they did. Yeah.
Fucking hell, I loved Your Highness, but no one likes Your Highness. But I loved it. I saw it twice at the cinema. I paid £30 to see it.
I was really up for it, and I didn't like it.
What, Your Highness?
Mm, oh, I was really up for the idea of it.
I really loved it, but. Yeah, but I've not really revisited it. But I thought it was a funny idea. Yeah, but so the team behind Your Highness have rebooted John Carpenter's Halloween, and it's really good. And I think that those moments of levity, when they're all just cunts being cunts, and then they all get killed by a cunt, it's like, who gives a shit? But when it's kind of like you've got these really kind of like, and also not in like Devil's Rejects way, where the victims are absolutely brutalised, and it's pornographic the way that they're treated, and then it's all kind of about celebrating the killers. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So like he glorifies it all.
I liked Rob Zombie's Halloween though. I think now it's become unpopular to say that. I liked it a lot.
Oh god, I thought it was fucking awful.
I liked it. I liked the first one. The second one,
fucking
I think it
pointless.
Unraveled a bit.
Well, I don't want to see him as like a kid that's kind of collecting roadkill, and and then he grows up to be Tyler Mayne, and then they get halfway through the film they realise, oh, we should probably just remake the original in half the time and take out all the it's terrible. I watched a little YouTube film about Rob Zombie's approach to Halloween, and he spent years leading up to making Halloween saying remakes are for absolute like cash grabs, and there's no dignity in making remakes, and why would anyone make a remake? And then they announced, oh, Rob Zombie's making a Halloween remake, and he goes, yeah, I think that, you know, the original Halloween's not perfect, and we can probably improve on the original Halloween. And you go, fuck off, can you improve on the original Halloween? Just make your own fucking film. And then he did all of that, and then he made Halloween 2, and he was like, going, yeah, I didn't want to make a remake in the first place, so now I get to do what I want to do with my own Halloween. And you just like, you're absolutely full of shit, and you change your story not a fan. We should probably play a song, but I'm going to play this song. This is the one I was going to tell you about. See if you can tell which song this reminds you of, which other song this reminds you of.
Run. Rag, 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 rag,
I'm lost for words with that song. You just don't go. It came out the year after Atomic.
The year after, did it?
Yeah,
that's
and
interesting.
It was off his album Special Forces, which was at the height of his crack addiction, and which is now canon. Right, for years, Alice Cooper said that he was an alcoholic in the '70s, and then he gave up alcohol, and then he started, and then he had one drink at dinner, and then he became an alcoholic again. And then what actually happened was. He was an alcoholic in the '70s. He had an intervention, and they basically
sobered up.
They put him in a mental hospital before Betty Ford clinics mm-hmm. existed, and he sobered up, came out, and wrote an album called From the Inside, all about his experiences in the mental hospital. And he co-wrote it with Bernie Taupin, and Bernie Taupin. Said, oh, let's not drink, but how about doing all this crack?
Takes the edge off, doesn't it? You're a bit craving some alcohol, probably. It's probably difficult to get through.
And
so you go, well, this will take the edge off.
This will take the edge off the cravings. let's smoke crack. And basically, Alice Cooper became addicted to crack and he almost killed himself.
And but to be fair, has he ever touched alcohol since?
No.
No, sir.
So, but Bernie Taupin, famous for being Elton John's co-writer. Yeah. The documentary Super Duper Alice Cooper I didn't know anything about that till I saw that documentary, and I cried because I was just like the pictures of Alice Cooper when he was like that ill, and you go right, he's a Christian golf playing fucking teetotal. Is he right wing? I don't know. He's quiet about politics, but I mean, I think he plays golf with Donald Trump.
Does he?
And you go, oh God. So just the least, but whatever you need to get you off the crack, mate. But it's still amazing. Anyway, so what happened must have been, and I can't find. There's nothing written about these albums. He made three albums that he doesn't remember making. I think it was Zipper Catches Skin, Special Forces, and Dada. Dada is a 5-star album. Dada is if anyone out there wants to get into Alice Cooper. And it's probably not a good one to get into
Alice
Cooper. I was
going to say, what would be the one that would get you into Alice Cooper?
I think the one that got me into Alice Cooper was Last Temptation. And I just think that has all of the bits it's like the perfect Alice Cooper album where it's got all of like the imagery and the horror aspects and the humour and the tunes. But it's when you listen to Welcome to My Nightmare, it's a bit silly. But Last Temptation is like it's really serious when it wants to be, and it's kind of quite chilling. I love that album. But Dada is one of the ones that it's a bit of a weird album, but when you get into it a bit later, it's great. But he doesn't remember making it. There's no information on any of that. Special Forces, and it's one of the ones where you just go, I want to know. How he made that album, but he just always says, "I don't remember making those three," and it's one of his best albums. And there's no anecdotes behind it, and it's really frustrating.
They did an episode of classic albums or whatever they used to do. There'd just be people going, "I don't
remember it." There's one guy that did remember it, who was called Dick Wagner, who was his guitarist, and he got a few anecdotes about him and Alice Cooper locked in a hotel in Aspen in the snow, and they wrote the album there. And Alice Cooper would sleep all day, drink all night, and then probably do crack. But they must have all been on a non-disclosure agreement that was like not part of its history.
Right.
And so there's little nuggets when you find other musicians that worked with them. Anyway, You Look Good in Rags. So You Look Good in Rags came out a year after Blondie's Atomic. And I reckon Blondie's Atomic, that had a rebirth. I don't know how big Blondie's Atomic was in 1980. Mm. And by the time he was doing the album, that had a rebirth after what? Was it Trainspotting they used it in?
Yeah, that was Atomic, yeah.
And that was really huge. And then Blondie had a big comeback at that point. And obviously, Blondie were big at the time, but they hadn't infiltrated popular culture to the point that...
Sure. But would Alice Cooper not have been aware of them as someone working in music?
Yeah, he absolutely would have.
Oh, okay, that's what I mean.
That's what
okay,
I'm saying. Yeah. I'm saying that it's an embarrassment when you listen back to it.
Oh,
where
sure,
you
yeah.
Go, where you go, Blondie, 1980, when that hasn't really seeped into the popular consciousness yet. It's a song that you've heard on the radio, and he's nicked it, and he's done this song that's got the exact same thing. And you go, wow, that is absolutely... Or whoever he was working with, the guitarist that he was working with, that came in and said, I've got this riff. Or it might have been like a Paul McCartney Yesterday moment, that's where they're just like... Well, I've heard this. I've got this thing in my head, and maybe I've stolen it. And everyone's like,
"But what happened was Alice Cooper probably came up with Yesterday, spoke to Paul McCartney, and said, Paul, I've just had this dream for this great song. Listen to this. And he's playing it whilst on crack, and it's Yesterday. And Paul goes, yeah, that's one of mine, actually, Alice. And he goes, oh, I see.
Yeah, okay. I've done it. I've done it again.
Feasibly, you could, I suppose, right? If you just had it in your head. But someone should have said, you know, that's...
I just think that they just thought, this song isn't big, and then the album came out, because they would have been doing the album about the same time, or just after, right? And then they released the album, and then all of a sudden Blondie has gone, like, stratospheric, and then they've gone... But he didn't care, he was off his face on crack, so he doesn't even
He's
remember.
Having a great time.
But, yeah, I just think it's such a... When I heard it, my jaw hit the floor. I was like, and I had to look up all the dates and everything. But I imagine that's what... There's the innocent version, which is he accidentally stole it. He'd heard it on the radio, and then he thought he'd invented it. Then there's someone else coming in and going, well, we need a riff, and we might as well use this. It's a bit similar to that. And then you go, no, it's the same. Well, then there's the whole fact that they just went out and did it because they just thought...
I put a joke on Twitter this week, and someone replied saying, oh, you've nicked so-and-so's joke. And I said, and I thought, have I? And it looked like I hadn't at all. Or it was obviously something they'd said to them in person. Or, like, there was no sort of trail to it. And you go, but conceivably, yeah, I can understand that someone could have come up with a similar joke to that.
Yeah. I did, but that's it. It's like, who invented the fork? It's just like, well, you know, it's, or who invented the spoon? It's just like, it's just kind of like, well, it's with jokes, it's really difficult. But the other thing about being original as well, in terms of like Alice Cooper and that song, you go, yeah, but why would he steal that one song?
Mm.
You know, he's done like 30 albums.
Yes.
And then it's like when people, I'd do like 5 one-liners at the beginning of my show, and someone accused me of stealing one of my jokes, and I was just like, why would I steal one joke? I've got like 5 songs in the show, I've got 4 poems, I've got stand-up, and then at the beginning I do 5 tiny one-liners. Why would I steal one-liner? Don't you think it's probably more likely that it's a coincidence? You know, it's like...
you've equally had jokes used by other
people
as well.
Steal off me all the fucking time. people don't just steal my jokes, people steal my act, my whole stage persona. And I've been in the audience while a guy's come on stage with a fucking guitar and shouted at people in the audience and done a poem, and then he's moved audience members around, and I've just gone, am I meant to just fuck, what am, I actually don't know what I'm meant to do in this situation. It's just fucking crazy. Last week I did I Think You Stink with Suze Kempner was in it.
And, I loved it, by the way, Nate.
Thank you. 5 stars. And Suze came up to me and said, my friend said that you stole something in your show, and then he remembered that he'd seen you do it on telly. And it's just like, what? So I've stolen off myself. And when I won Best Joke of the Year of, what was it, 2011, I needed a password 8 characters long, so I picked Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs, right? Wonderful, right? So,
lovely stuff.
But the thing about that is, like, so my dad wrote it in an email, to me. And it was a long email, and it was a long rambling anecdote which culminated in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, right? It wasn't a one-liner. And so I kind of rewrote it for him, and I sent it back and said, we have a lot of back and forth like that, where he'll write a joke and then I'll correct it because it doesn't make any sense. And so that's what happened then.
I can't believe you ripped off your dad's joke.
And then I needed 30 jokes. Then I was doing my 30 jokes, right? At the beginning, when I was doing my previews, and I'd go through all the jokes and I'd get rid of the rubbish ones, and then I'd end up with the five that worked every time. Which seems like a lot more work than I would do now. Unbelievably, it made all the cuts and it got all the way down to the final five, and I couldn't believe it, right? And then what happens is you're doing your show in Edinburgh. I think people probably think that you enter a competition or something, but you don't. You're doing a show in Edinburgh, and then the TV company, Dave, turn up, and they sit in the darkness, and then they write your jokes down, and then they go off and they put them online, and you go, that's not right. And then at the end of the month, they go, congratulations, you've won. And you go, well, yeah, I've won, but I won't be able to use that joke anymore because now you've published it in the Sun and everybody knows it. And all you're giving me is £1,000 to steal my material that I never entered into a competition.
But also, it's worse that if you're just one of the top 10 that doesn't win, you also have their joke published and don't get any money for it.
So they give you. I couldn't. That was an amazing year for me. But they gave me an award. They gave me a trophy type thing. It's a Perspex elephant. That said Dave on it, and £1,000. So I shared it with my dad. I gave him the trophy.
Hey!
But then when you do that, you haven't put yourself in that position. Dave have put you in that position. Yes. And they open you up to all of this criticism, where all of a sudden people were like going, and that was, I was always really open that it was like a collaboration between me and my dad. But it's a fucking one-liner, right? And all of a sudden these people, I got one saying, I don't believe you or your father wrote that joke. Another guy wrote to me and said, I once cheated in an egg and spoon race. And although I won, the victory was rather hollow. I wonder how you're feeling now.
But why did they thought you'd stolen it?
I've no idea. Right. But all you do is you just like go, I've got...
So someone's saying, I didn't like that joke, you shouldn't have won. Well, I don't know what their problem is.
All of a sudden, everyone's going like, well, that's not your joke. And you're just like going, well, it is my joke. And I've got all the working out to prove it. You know, fucking hell. I mean, I saw someone do something that I did on telly once. Someone did something I did on stage, on telly, and I confronted them about it. And I was like, what's that about? And they said, oh, it just came to me. And it's just like, it was jumping up and down on a mini trampoline, but doing a very specific thing that was only something that I did in my live show. And actually, I did it in Heavy Entertainment, but we were filming it at the same time that they aired theirs. And it's just like, I know why I did it. Why did you do it on telly? And they said, oh, it just came to us. It's like, it came to you to jump up and down on television on a mini trampoline doing a very specific thing. Why? How did it? It just came to us. It's just like, well, I know why I did it, right? I did it because the mini trampoline fit in the back of my girlfriend's car, right? And we drove up to Edinburgh, right? Why did you do it on a TV budget when you wouldn't have needed a mini trampoline? You could have used anything. And it's just like, you haven't got any of your working out in front of you. You didn't just fucking come to you. This is fucking...
Or it did, but it came to you via you.
It happened in a very... You were on crack and you were listening to... You were watching my live stuff, and then the next day you thought, fucking hell, yeah, I've got an amazing idea. I'm going to put that on my fucking TV show. I'm not really that angry about it, but I do think that it's just such a... I think there is murkiness sometimes, and then there is theft.
I'd also say that when I come up with a joke that I think seems very neat, I always try and search keywords in it to see if it's been done before.
Yeah, and I always kind of like try and have a very flippant attitude to one-liners, where you just kind of like, the odds are that someone has already
it. Absolutely.
You put it out there, and if somebody says it, you go, fair enough. But I think it was sort of like one of those things where I had a really great joke. One of my favourite jokes was Tim Rice and Tim Curry got together and opened up an Indian takeaway. they called it Tim's, right? And I don't think it was that. It was like, do you ever think that Tim Rice and Jim Curry should get together and open up an Indian takeaway? They could call it Tim's. It would be ideal, right? And I like that. It would be ideal, even more than the actual punchline, right? And then I think a big comedian started doing that joke. And you go, yeah, of course. There's two guys called Tim. One of them's called Tim Rice and one of them's called Tim Curry. And you go, I don't believe that they've stolen that one joke off me. You go, that's just a coincidence. That's how it happens. You're saying, keep it light. Oh, no, that's the thing. Oh, we've got some reviews that we've got to read out. This is a phenomenal podcast. If you love movies, cult shows, comedy, then this is the show for you.
I don't know if we should read reviews. It sounds
I think
a
it's
bit
awful. It's just like it's cannibalising yourself.
It's a bit grubby.
It's the sort
I appreciate
of thing
it.
That Brett Goldstein's would do, isn't it?
I find it a little bit grubby, you're reading them out.
It's like, it's kind of like, yeah, but thank you for all the
thank you for saying it.
Thank you for all the nice comments that we get, because we do read them and it actually does pathetically make me feel like
it's a phenomenal. Okay, the two hosts are great. Nick is cool and Nathaniel is a total hun, and their chemistry together makes the show, and brilliant as it is, this show is a must listen.
Yeah,
well, that's very nice.
Natilla the hun, you probably need to just get a proofreader.
There's someone who said that they're watching, they've got up at 6 a.m. on my day off fan club, and that's why he didn't need to get up at 6 a.m. He should have got up at midday.
This is better than 4 stars. Yeah, five. That's what happened. This week, someone tweeted me and they said, I found this really funny. They tweeted me this week and they said, I've just given your short, The Killing Machine, 7 out of 10 on IMDb. And you go, why? So I wrote back to him and I wrote, and this is my review of you, 1 out of 10, right? It's like, it's a weird sort of like, and then I read the review that he wrote and it's a fucking glowing review whose main concern is the fact that it's not long enough. And you go, it's a short. It's a short film. I had the parameters of...
But you could say, I've given your show 10 out of 10. I loved it. And he'd go, oh, thanks very much.
You can't go 7 out of 10. You've given me 3.5 out of 5. What? I mean, why would you tell the person that you've got... It's not a bad review. It's not negative. He's not slammed me. He's been really positive.
Hey, just doing a show. I thought it was fine.
Yeah, exactly. I've just gone on IMTV to tell the world that your show is average. You're welcome. It's kind of like, you're not like saying, you are shit, mate. You are shit. I fucking hate you. You are fucking shit, cunt. Right? Which is what Twitter was invented for.
Sure.
He's like going, you were all right.
I turned it on. I didn't turn it off.
It was great. It was great to have on in the background when I did the ironing. It was like that's what I call later Bon Jovi. It's ironing music. It's the sort of thing that my mum used to listen to. It's my life, yeah. I'll do it now or never. You're sleeping with my best mate, Trevor. I just want to live while I'm alive. Like empty sentiments. It's kind of like fucking hell, ironing music. We should play your song and then get our guest on.
Yes.
We've got, what's your song?
Jackie. By Scott Walker.
Scott Walker. And then we've joined in you by Lucy Porter.
And if one day I should become a singer with a Spanish bum who sings for women of great virtue, I'd sing to them with a guitar I borrowed from a coffee bar. Well, what you don't know doesn't hurt you. My name would be Antonio, and all my bridges I would burn. And when I gave them some, they'd know I'd expect something in return. I'd have to get drunk every night and talk about virility with some old grandmama who might be decked out like a Christmas tree. And though pink elephants I'd see, though I'd be drunk as I could be, still I would sing my song to me about the time they called me Shacky. If I could be for only an hour, if I could be for an hour every day, if I could be for just one little hour, a cute, in a stupid-ass way. And if I joined the social world, became procurer of young girls, then I would have my own bordellos. My record would be number one, and I'd sell records by the ton, all sung by many other fellows. My name would then be Handsome Jack, and I'd sell bolts of opium, whiskey that came from Twickenham, off many queers and phony virgins. If I had banks on every finger, finger in every country, and all the countries ruled by me, I'd still know where I'd want to be. Locked up inside my opium den, surrounded by some Chinamen, I'd sing the song that I sang then about the time they called me Shacky. If I could be for only an hour, if I could be for an hour every day, if I could be for just one little hour, a cute, cute in a stupid-ass way. Now tell me, wouldn't it be nice that if one day in paradise I'd sing for all the ladies up there, and they would sing along with me, we'd be so happy there to be, cause down below is really nowhere. And if my name were Juniper, then I would know where I was going, and then I would become all-knowing, my beard so very long and flowing. If I became deaf, dumb and blind, because I pitied all mankind and broke my heart to make things right, I'd know that every single night. When my angelic work was through, the angels and the devil too would sing my childhood song to me about the time they called me Shacky. If I could be for only an hour, if I could be for an hour every day, if I could be for just one little hour, a cute, cute in a stupid-ass way.
Is that your end of song?
I panicked a bit because I thought it was wrapping up. And then
it was wrapping up.
It was, but it went on for fucking ages.
It gave a clear
ages,
indication
it?
Of it was wrapping up.
It went on for fucking ages.
Gave the old Scott Walker flourish.
We're joined in the studio now by Lucy Porter, comedian.
Hi.
But before we get into that, we've got to tie up a loose end about Hammer Horror.
All I was saying was that it wasn't the. It was.
I'd have a habit of cutting him off. Is the thing.
Yes.
And then we move on.
Yes.
You just did when he was.
That's what I was doing.
Oh,
it works. Always working.
Just saying that they became Universal. Ended up buying a lot of Hammer property after they did The Curse of Frankenstein. And they started producing them from Dracula on for a period of about a year.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf.
Carry on.
No, that's it. Anyway, we've got a guest now, so it's rude. Yeah, it'd be rude to carry on.
I don't know
talking.
Anything about Hammer.
It's all right. That's not what you're here for.
That's fine. Well, no, because I wanted you to continue just to, annoy.
Just finish it off.
I finished it.
What was it?
Universal. No, they ended up producing Hammer movies via. Hammer would make them. But they would produce them and distribute them for Hammer.
That's nice of them.
It is nice.
And I guess it sort of meant that they didn't have to make the films themselves.
Exactly.
Hello, how are you doing?
Hi, very good.
Thanks for coming in.
Well, it's my absolute pleasure. This is very much my thing, enthusiasm.
You're doing you're doing your own podcast, aren't you?
I am.
And what's that called?
It's called Fingers on Buzzers.
And what's this about?
It's about my great love of quizzing. So it's me and the Chase, right?
I love the Chase.
And
is that the one with Bradley Walsh?
It is.
Oh, he's good, isn't he?
Oh God, he is amazing. And there's a woman on it, the Vixen.
Yes, I know the Vixen.
Jenny Ryan. And so she and I do it together.
Is it about quizzing
entirely about quizzing.
Oh, so it's not a quiz?
There are quizzes in it, because obviously if you can't help it. I mean, I always put a quiz in anything I do. Every Edinburgh show I've ever done has always ended up having a quiz at some point, whether I want one or not.
With the audience?
Yeah. Although I prefer to participate than set, really.
Sure.
So Jen and I did the Celebrity Chase and met her, and we got on and we decided to do this podcast. And it's sort of about quizzes, like tele quizzes.
That's really nice. So when you watch that episode of The Chase, you can see a friendship blossoming.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful moment.
Have you done any other TV celebrity things?
It's all I live for now. The entire purpose of me continuing to do comedy is so that I get invited to do quiz shows.
So have you done loads?
I've done Weakest Link, Pointless, 15 to 1, Mastermind, Test the Nation with Anne Robinson. Short-lived, but
what was
fun.
Your specialist subject?
What was Test the Nation?
Oh. Test the Nation. It was Anne... And I've got a feeling Philip Schofield was there, maybe, or maybe he wasn't. I don't know. But Anne Robinson
always is.
He was looming somewhere. And then Anne Robinson hosts, and they had like groups of teachers. And
I think I remember this.
And they had, I tell you what, it was really awkward. The one I did, one of the groups they had was radio presenters. But they treated the radio presenters like normal contestants. And you know, like on telly, often the audience are treated like shit. And so it was really awful and really embarrassing because loads of these radio presenters, they're like local radio people that I've worked with and I know. And I was kind of being, you know, powdered down and brought drinks and food and having someone peeling me grapes and wafting me. And then, like, other people I knew were being like, come on, no, you can't talk to her. She's the talent.
Oh, no.
So that was the worst thing about it. But I did win it. I won it. Me and Barbara Dixon were the strongest contestants on the night.
Lovely stuff.
And yeah, so it was good. And that was my second exposure to Anne Robinson. And so I've seen nice Anne Robinson.
She was nice on Test the Nation.
She was nice on Test the Nation, and she was so horrible on The Weakest Link. And I thought, God,
it's an act, though, is it?
Well, yeah, but she's method. She's the Dustin Hoffman of quizzing. And so she's really horrible to you, like, the whole time. And you don't really meet her much when you're in the studio.
Yeah.
But she's an absolute cow the entire way through.
Yeah. I mean, what did I do? I did, what's the one, Deal or No Deal?
Oh, yeah.
That was an experience.
I bet it was. whose pick was it?
I think it was Jimmy Carr.
Yeah.
Both times. I think they did, the one that I did, yeah, so I think what they did was they did Celebrity Deal or No Deal with Jimmy Carr, and Sarah Millican did one, and then someone else did one.
Yeah.
And it was Noel Edmonds. And then we were box openers. And then when they were doing reformatting 8 out of 10 Cats to Countdown, they did it with about three different things. I think they did 8 out of 10 Cats does Deal or No Deal, Countdown, and 15 to 1 maybe.
Okay.
And then the Countdown one was the most successful, and then that became a series.
Yeah.
But they didn't Deal or No Deal, and Noel wasn't there. But the one with Noel was absolutely spectacular.
Yeah, well, did you go to Bristol and did you have to stay over?
Yeah, it was...
You did the proper experience, cult...
It was jaw-dropping. The stuff that Noel was doing that he knew wouldn't make it on air was just...
Really?
It was fucking...
Blue or...
Crazy stuff.
What?
It was crazy stuff.
I don't know. Are we allowed to talk about this?
It was
looking nervously at the producers.
I mean, this is probably a conversation best left off air.
Yeah, great.
We'll find out anyway.
Oh, God, that's so tantalising. Poor
tell you,
listeners.
I'll tell
sorry,
you
guys.
During a song, but Noel Edmonds.
Play a song.
Noel Edmonds.
An interesting
was
man.
Absolutely insane. He would say some of the most offensive stuff I'd ever heard to us as guests.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Well, he doesn't care. He's just reached that point where I don't think he actually cares. I think he probably would put it out.
I'll tell you one of the things. There was a female comedian, and we were going around the thing, and she said something like, this is in front of all the audience and everything like that. He said something like, she said something like, I've got a good feeling in my box. And he, you know, box's vagina joke.
Sure.
And he goes, oh, come on, right? We've been doing this show for 10 years. 10 years we've been doing this show. Can we just have it once and for all with the box is vagina jokes? Please. I mean, you're a professional comedian. You're a professional comedian.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? You should be trying a little bit harder than that. And he told her off and all of us off.
Wow.
And it was just like, what? Okay, I'll tell you some.
That's
more,
amazing, right? But I sort of am on his side in a way there. I think, you know, you do
say, I just think, drop it, mate. Just get on. Don't tell her off in front of everyone, right? And then there was a portly guy.
Yeah.
I'm not going to name any of the comedians, right?
But
he walked down at the beginning, you know, and just a, you know, slightly above average sized, and and he goes, we call that the walk of wealth, and by the looks of it, it looks like you could do with a bit of a walk. Ooh. And he turned around and he said, are you calling me fat? And he was just like, and what he'd do is he would just raise his hands in the air and puff his face out and go like that, and then he'd
a cartoon Frenchman,
like, and he's just absolutely absolving him of any of any connection to what has just happened.
The universe, yeah. That's so it. Then the universe has given
ordered.
Him exactly.
I've he's given, he's given away. Yeah.
So then later on in the episode, Noel's been horrible to all of us. Like at some point, and the guy who he said walk of wealth to, right, just turns around and goes, all right, Noel, we've had it with you, right? You've been saying all of this stuff. You've been saying it to her. You've been saying it to me. You've done all of this, right? And I think that you, actually, are not a very nice guy. Ooh. And you've got there's a real problem. They left that bit in the show, and they cut out the bit where he insulted everyone, and it made it look like he was attacking Noel Edmonds on his own show. Ooh. And Noel's just there going, I don't know what that's about. And it's just like, because it was absolutely insane. And there was one bit where they get a picture of I won't tell you the worst thing that happened, but I'll tell you the thing that was just really.
This is so good. This is like the best thing I've ever heard.
I'll tell you the thing that actually made me it still makes me laugh to the day. They showed a picture of, because it was Jimmy Carr. They showed a picture of Quagmire from Family Guy, on the set, and basically the joke is that Jimmy Carr looks like Quagmire. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, Jimmy Carr probably gets it a lot, or he didn't really know how to react. He didn't want to lower himself to actually responding to the joke or anything. So he turns around, Noel says, the banker seems to think you look a little bit like Quagmire. And so Jimmy Carr turns around and he says, just tell the banker, giggity, giggity. And Noel goes, like, giggity goo. But he doesn't. it's like he slides right up to Jimmy Carr, and with like little kind of like cat paws goes a giggity goo, and Jimmy just turns around to Noel and he goes, creepy Noel, real creepy. and now to this day, I still think it's funny. You go, come on girl, let's get gooey. It's so fucking disgusting. Let's get gooey. A giggity goo. It was just
doesn't Noel Edmonds drive around in a black cab which has a blow up doll in the back so he doesn't get fares? But you go, but imagine seeing him at some traffic lights and going, oh God, what's going on?
Yeah.
Who's that? What's happening?
Who's he killed now? Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, he's had a...
What was that show that he did one recently with a load of comics, didn't he? And
they were driving around with their partners, weren't they?
No. Oh, I don't know.
He did one where he was driving around, like, Istanbul with his wife and they were arguing in the car.
Oh, God, yes. And he... Now, was this public knowledge, or did someone tell me this, that he had a massive tantrum because he said that everyone else cheated? But what actually happened was he was the only person who was taking it deathly seriously, and everyone else was like, it's telly. Clearly, I'm not going to drive from, you know, London to Istanbul. That would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
But he went absolutely nuts and said, this is TV fakery. This would never have happened in my day.
We're told that Noel Edmonds' blow up dolls is called Candy's Cans. And yes, there she is.
Why is she called Candy's Cans?
Yeah, she is. And
he released a dance track with suggestive catchphrases from Deal or No Deal under the name. Can we play out with that?
Candy's Can.
That's
and
horrific.
She's wearing a riding hat.
She is.
Which is like a fetish layered on a fetish, isn't it?
Yes. And also riding in the back of a cab, which seems overly safe.
Sit up
but
front.
Good health and safety.
She has got a seatbelt.
She's on point.
So he drives a black cab, does he?
Yeah.
Well, that's so that it doesn't get flagged down.
Right. I think so. Doesn't
Stephen
have a
Fry drives a black cab, and he's always getting flagged down. So I imagine
there is something. If you're famous and you go for a quirky vehicle, to me that is a little bit try hard. I'm just going to say that. I just think that if you're Noel Edmonds, I would have a Mondeo.
If you are going to drive a taxi, I would say almost the opposite, but I would say that if you are going to decide to drive a taxi, expect to try and get flagged down.
Yeah.
Right? Don't get so pissed off. I'm freaking really fed up with people flagging me down. I'm going to buy a sex doll and dress her up. And I'm not going to use her for sex. I'm going to do something, actually. I'm going to think outside her box.
I was curious.
I'm actually going to just stop her from use her as a decoy to me getting bloody flagged down.
So you'd be going, oh, I'm furious. I bought myself a Rootmaster and then someone keeps hanging off the back of it. It's like, yeah, well, that's probably going to happen. It will happen if you've done it.
Crazy. So you did Mastermind.
Yeah.
What was your specialist subject?
Did you finish talking about Anne Robinson?
Yeah, just she wasn't very nice, and then she was nice.
Sorry, Hammer Films had...
she was in a Hammer film.
I'll tell you what was a Hammer film. Mm-hmm. On the Buses. That's
was
Fan Club.
Film? With,
yeah,
Rob Depp.
The three On the Buses movies.
Robert Depp has informed us that the last Hammer movie...
This is getting worse.
Oh, my God. It's Noel Edmonds, who is in fancy dress as Chuck Norris... sat in between a real woman, I'm assuming his wife, and a fake woman who has obviously got to his destination and is just having a cup of tea.
The fake woman is about to pour a pot of tea.
She's got six fingers.
She's got sort of graspable fingers, yes. Which you think that's
of course,
a bit...
that's for wanking.
Yeah, I mean,
what you do is she can either use them to hail a cab, mm-hmm. Or she can use them to wank Noel Edmonds off.
Of all the people to talk about, I mean, he's notoriously angry and litigious. Yeah, I mean, he's suing Lloyd's Bank or something.
Oh.
So he could bring down FUBAR and all of us individually within minutes if he chose.
He could easily bring me down, I'll tell you that much.
Well, exactly.
It wouldn't take much to bring me down.
I mean, it's a sex doll, isn't it? They don't sell
I mean,
dolls.
Actually, no,
they don't
fairness,
sell dolls just to sit in the back of taxis,
it,
do
no,
they?
No, it's a mannequin. It isn't a sex doll. It is a mannequin. I'm going to try and claw this back.
Oh, my God.
He wears a fake beard.
He's joined Mumford and Sons. he wears a fake beard. Why? Because so that people... I'll tell you who I had in the front of my cab the other day. Noel Edmonds. Fucking... So he did Mastermind. How did you find John Humphreys? Is it John Humphreys that does it?
Yeah, it is John Humphreys.
Yeah.
I am not a fan on the Today programme, but actually very pleasant company.
Was he?
He was pleasant company. He was very nice to my father-in-law, which I think that's the mark of a nice celebrity, is if they're nice to your, you know, your fan and friends. Mm. But, you know, it was all right. It was, you know... Yeah, it was all right, actually. And the experience of doing it was amazing because it is the pinnacle of quizzing.
If you're someone who's grown up on...
That's the one I did.
Pardon?
Did it make you nervous?
I was nervous. I was very, very nervous.
Is it designed to make you, put you at unease?
Yes, it is. Well, what's the theme tune to Mastermind is called...
Fucking stressful.
It's called Approaching Menace.
Right.
Right.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what it is, but I'm sure the producers will look it up for
it
me.
Was, when you're sat at the chairs and the music starts, it's like you're in the telly now. Do you know what I mean? Because it's such a famous bit of music and it's like you're... Ugh.
And the chair, and it is that weird thing where you sort of think, oh my God, I'm actually in the telly.
Yeah.
And... although, I mean, I sort of remember it more from the Magnus Magnusson era.
Mm.
So to me, John Humphreys is
a bit pretender
young,
to
pretender,
the throne.
But
he wasn't particularly nice to me.
Also, the thing is, I did do it was the comic relief special. So it wasn't, I mean, it was, they really do dumb down the questions.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Who were the other contestants?
So there was Dave Spikey, who'd won it before, talking about blood, which is his, because he's a haematologist.
But had he won it before on Real Mastermind and then he did the comic
relief
one?
No, he'd done another celebrity one, I think.
But not a comic relief one?
But not a comic relief one.
They shouldn't dumb it down. I think that seems offensive,
I know.
Right?
Well, because also, so he is a quizzer and he was doing the Leeds to Manchester Ship Canal. And then Mark Watson was on and he was doing the World Cup since 1979 or something, which is insanely hard.
It was an insane waste of life.
I was doing the life and works of Steve Martin. And Stephen K. Amos was doing Five Star the Romford band of the 80s.
Five Star, the band from the 80s.
Yeah.
Five
wow.
Star. Where were they from? Romford?
Romford, yeah.
I thought they were American.
Well, do you know what, right? So the questions were so easy, and I had done so much research on Steve Martin. So in fact, I did get one question wrong, but I mean, you know, they were just all the questions you would think they would ask. Mm-hmm. And I'd seen what subjects everyone else was doing. So just because I'm interested, I had a quick look at, you know, some information about their stuff. And I read the Wikipedia page about Five Star, and basically, every question they asked about Five Star was on their Wikipedia page. And
how many
Stephen
questions
K.
can
Amos,
you have about Five Star?
Well, you know, what are they all called, mm-hmm. right? Where are they from, and what were their songs? I mean, that is it. Because
they were
so squeaky clean.
6 weeks in 1987.
Yeah. And they had a lot of hits. They did have a lot of hits. But Stephen K. Amos, he scored 4. Which, like,
how many did you score?
I would have scored about 12. And it is,
how can you
just
get 4 on your specialist subject?
And it
that's
was
like,
because
that's
he was
one better than Sam Ashurst.
He was there for comedy and not for quizzing, which is something I never get. You know, because when I do these, I'm there for the quizzing.
Absolutely.
And I
so
don't
you
care.
Should be.
Yeah, I mean, getting so laughs is be. Overrated generally, I think.
That's crazy. 4.
But yeah, it was like Chris Ramsey when we did The Weakest Link, just, you know, knew the answers and didn't say the right answer because he thought of something funnier. And I was looking at him and I was like, I admire you as a comedian, but as a human being, I don't understand you at all.
I don't respect this.
No, I really, I just have no idea how you can
yeah,
do that.
It overrides everything,
that quiz. It does, doesn't it?
What, The Weakest Link?
No, if someone was doing a quiz, I couldn't try and be funny. I'd be like, shush,
I
want to get the answer.
Oh, I mean, I've had, because like, I do a lot of pub quizzes and I've taken, you know, friends who I get on with and love, and and then they sort of get bored and they start chatting and they're like, oh, it doesn't really matter. And I'm absolutely furious. My friend Barinka, who I will name and shame, because she's so intelligent and she's like, I was like, she's going to be amazing at this pub quiz. And she just, yeah, couldn't be asked after, you know, the first couple of rounds.
I love pub quizzes.
Oh,
I'm not a chatter, but I'll tell you what, I take them very seriously, but what I'm not, I don't hide my paper.
No.
Or snatch pens. People who snatch pens and
oh,
things.
Oh, God.
Go, oh, don't snatch a pen off me.
I mean, or cheat. I mean, yes. I just find, because we, in the one that I go to regularly, the first round is always, you know, stuff in the news. And there are people who bring in the papers and just have a little, and I'm like, that is just,
that's not
why
right.
would you do that?
That's not right, especially when you've got Google on your phone. Oh, why would you bring in papers?
Oh,
what would you do? No, I think cheating in a pub quiz is absolutely abhorrent. Oh. But also, we did a pub quiz the other week with Natalie, didn't we? Mm-hmm. And every time I knew the answer to something, she's got so little respect for me that she just had to double check it with less intelligent people at the table. You know? I found it offensive, to be fair.
Yeah.
And even today, when I was like saying, "Oh, there's a nice review of a fan club. There's one that says that I'm cool in it, right?" And because it was sort of bigging myself up a little bit, she refused to believe me. And she was like saying, "Where's this? Where's this? Where's this?" And she got Nat. And she got Nat on her side saying, "Where's this review that says you're cool, Nick? Where's this review that says you're cool?" She's like, "Well, I didn't make it up." "Didn't you? Because it seems to be in your interest." This happened during one of the songs that we've been playing in this show. And I've been bottling it up too long and I'm letting it out now.
It's your Noel Edmonds moment.
And then she found it. And then she found the quote and she refused to apologise.
I think it's something about men with beards, maybe. I don't know what it is.
Sometimes I have a beard, keep it light. Sometimes I have a beard, and sometimes I don't have a beard. That's how facial hair works.
But have you got a blow-up doll?
What? It's not a whole doll. It's a rubber glove. It's a marigold, and I blow it up, and I use it to wank off Noel Edmonds. So your specialist subject was Steve Martin. Do you really love Steve Martin?
I adore Steve Martin, and I just sat and watched all his films for 3 days before I went and did the show, and it was the best 3 days I've ever spent in my life. She's coming.
So you
now,
just did it via osmosis. You got your info
the proper
way.
Yeah, exactly. Just by immersing myself in the subject.
And would it have been one of those things that when you heard the questions, you're like, I would have got these anyway.
I mean, I'm pretty, you know, I'm a bit of a fangirl anyway, and I would have known most of it. Even, you know, some of his more obscure banjo work.
Do you remember your questions?
I do. I remember the one I got wrong, of course, because you always do.
What was the one you got wrong?
The one I got wrong was which character did he voice in The Simpsons?
Oh, yeah, that's a hard one.
It is, and I still can't remember, actually.
No, I don't know.
I remember the getting it wrong, but I didn't actually go to the lengths of correcting it.
My special subject was Alice Cooper. And
nice.
And I was reading a book about Alice Cooper the night before. Mm-hmm. I'd done, you know, loads of research, and there was a bit while I was reading. I was either reading or maybe I was listening to it. Or no, I think I was reading it. Mm-hmm. And there was a very specific bit where I kind of like was dozing off, and it was about one of their first gigs that they did in London where they were supporting a band, and I sort of like drifted off, and then I sort of woke up and I was sort of like, I've got to plow on through this book. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, should I reread that bit? I was like, they'll never ask me about that. And then I plowed on through the book, and then the one question I got, I passed one question, and I got one question wrong. And the one I passed, I think, was specifically about, and it must have been three sentences that I drifted off on. And it was specifically about the three sentences that I drifted off on. And I think the answer was The Who.
Oh,
which band did they support in the Rainbow Rooms in Finchley Park in 1970, whatever. And it was, and I really, but it's so weird because I specifically remember the bit where I lost that point. Which is, I just drifted off during that. It's such a, it was like halfway through a book as well, like three sentences halfway through a book. But
and who was on with you? Did you win?
No, I didn't. I came second. I can't remember who was on with me. I know that the
who beat you.
It was an actress.
Which shows you good luck that you don't. It isn't imprinted in your brain.
Yeah, I would.
I'd be furious.
Absolutely. Yeah, she'd be getting anonymous letters.
I'm not watching any of her shows anymore.
I did really well. I came second. There was an Olympian.
One of them losers.
No, he was. He had. Fake limbs because he'd been in an accident, and then he'd become like a. I can't remember the names of anyone, but his special subject was Terminator. And so we were backstage, and I was like going, I was trying to be helpful, and I was in high spirits because I've got two settings backstage on a TV show. I'm either get really nervous, mm-hmm. or I just get really hyperactive.
Yeah.
I prefer to be hyperactive because it's a miserable day when you're nervous.
Yeah.
So I was backstage just like going, all right, so who played the T-1000 in Terminator 2? And he goes, what? I don't know. And I said, your special subject is Terminator.
Oh, no.
How can you not know that? It's Robert Patrick.
I know.
Right? And then he went out, and his question was, who played the T-1000 in Terminator 2? And he went, Robert Patrick. And when he sat back down next to me, I went, you're welcome. But I was only trying to help him out. Do you know what I mean?
No.
The girl that won, I can't remember her name.
Was it Kimberly Nixon?
Kimberly Nixon, that's right.
There you go. That's fan club.
Her special subject was...
Who is Kimberly Nixon?
I don't know.
She's an actress. She's in Fresh Meat. And her special subject was Agatha Christie. And you go, right, and there's a lot of Agatha Christie.
Sure is, yeah.
And fucking hell, she had questions like, what does G&T stand for? And she'd say, gin. And then John Humphries would go, gin and tonic. And he would go like, hang on a minute, how much fucking help are you giving her? This is fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
And she had really short, and this is a lot. You know, I'd have like, in the years 1973, when Alice
question.
Cooper was touring, what was the item of clothing that he was said to have worn in the Rolling Stone article? It's just like, how long is this fucking question, mate? You go, it was a fucking pair of shoes, mate. Shoes. Right?
And she got, what's
a G&T? What does G&T stand for?
Yeah.
Oh, gin. And then one of the questions was, what was the murder weapon from the end of one of Agatha Christie's books?
Yeah.
And she would say, and she said, oh, it was a rock. He goes, it was an ornamental paperweight. Yes, I'll accept that. And you'd go, what?
Oh, my God.
Hang on a minute.
Yeah, I'd have lost it.
I had really long questions and
he was helping her out.
And he was helping her.
Yeah.
And I think he referred to them both as sex symbols. And it was a very uncomfortable moment. But also...
Who both?
Her and him.
Oh, God. Oh.
It was uncomfortable. And but also and then he went out of his way to help her, and then it was like with me, I said something that was slightly self-deprecating, and he goes, What do you mean? You're saying that you're not very good at something? You're not very good, then why are you here?
It's a funny old one.
And it's just like,
it?
I'm being self-deprecating. I am obviously amazing. That's why I'm here.
Yeah, I know everything about Alice Cooper. It's that I think, though, yeah, he's sort of, it's not 100% clear what his persona is it?
Yes.
Because he is, like, nice. I think he is nicer to women than he is to men.
I think that's his
that
persona.
That might be it.
He's the people's pervert. it was a bit weird. But also, I think on any other one, I would have won.
Yeah.
I don't find him very warm, but I found Magnus Magnusson was serious but quite warm.
I don't think
he's a cold person. He seems quite a nice...
Well, and he had that sort of nice sort of northern, Icelandic-y, Scottish-y kind of...
A soothing voice.
Yeah. Sally Magnusson is still on she's still on the local news in Scotland. It's lovely to see her. Lovely to see her.
There was that Mastermind Peg game, wasn't there?
Yeah.
It wasn't related
at
all.
Unrelated. It was nothing to do
with it, I know. So, what's your favourite... Let's talk about Steve Martin, because I love Steve Martin.
Yeah. Okay. Probably the jerk. Probably it's the sort of the comedian in me. Probably the jerk.
I love the first half of the jerk, and then the second half sort of like, I still love it, but it sort of gets a little bit.
I know what you mean.
I love the bit with the cans. Just everything, like every single scene for the first 45 minutes.
It's front loaded with great gags and visuals.
And then it
and
becomes
the glasses
more
thing and all that.
Yeah, I love, but. I would say that the first half is like
top three.
Top three Steve Martins.
I would say probably Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, just for the Ruprecht.
Oh wow! Yeah,
scene.
It's amazing. I love the film.
But also, when you watch Bedtime Story, the original David Niven, Marlon Brando, the Ruprecht scene is almost exactly the same when Marlon Brando's doing it. It's kind of like you think, oh wow, Steve Martin's a comedy genius, and then you watch the Marlon Brando do it, and you go, oh my god, it's almost the same. It's crazy because you don't think of Marlon Brando like that. Yeah. But Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is
funny.
I had forgotten about Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, but that would be really high up, yeah.
I haven't seen it in ages.
Me either.
Frank Oz.
I do love it.
They've remade it as well. They've remade it called. No. What's it called? It's called. This quote. Oh, God. What's it? The Australian comedian woman, Rainn Wilson. No, not Rainn Wilson. What's her name?
Rebel Wilson.
Rebel Wilson. And who was Catwoman in the last Batman one?
Anne Hathaway.
So Anne Hathaway and Rebel Wilson are playing. And it's called something like Evil Women or Mean Women. Or
but it's Dirty Rotten Scoundrels in all but names.
They've done a gender swap.
Gender swapped.
Okay.
And I don't know how...
Nasty
Women. And I don't know how the gender swap really benefits in this, because surely if it's a gender swap, that means that it's a film about two women that get duped by a cleverer man.
At the end,
yes.
Yes,
you're right.
Yes, it would be a way to.
I don't know.
That's true equality. That's true equality. Yeah. Yeah, but
it's kind of like misjudged slightly. It's like,
I haven't seen it. Wouldn't watch it.
Yeah.
I would like to see a gender swapped Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, just for it's such a good buddy road movie.
It is, but they did sort of like that with what was that Hop Suit that they did with Reese Witherspoon. They've done sort of like female road movies, and I only worked out that Hot Pursuit. What's the name of the actress that's in it with Reese Witherspoon? Is it?
I don't know.
Sophia. It's the one out of Modern Family.
Sophia Vergara.
I only worked out that the title Hot Pursuit is a pun, isn't it? They've gone, oh, she's hot.
Hot.
So they're
still all about sexy.
Not that I've even seen the film or thought about it much at all, but like I have only just worked out that it was a pun. But
good quiz question about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yes.
Is which city are they going back to?
Oh, I don't know. I remember it's...
Is it in Connecticut? No, that's Christmas in Connecticut. Do you know who directed the remake?
Yes.
Do you know who directed the remake of Christmas in Connecticut?
No.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Okay.
So, where are they going back to?
They're going back to Chicago. And it is, and people always think it's Christmas because over here you've got to go, it's like a Christmas movie because it's snowy and everything. But
it's a fucking amazing film. Although.
When did John Candy die? That wasn't.
He
that
died
long ago.
In 1993, halfway through filming Wagons East. He'd just finished Canadian Bacon, which was the last film to be released, and Wagons East was the film that was made before, and he died halfway through, and they had to CGI him on the back of a horse.
Wow. Bloody hell. I tell you what, that actually...
1994.
Right. I do now think I do want to be on your pub quiz team so bad.
I mean,
are you good across everything?
No. Well, I'm bad on sport. I've got no sport.
Yeah, I've got no sport, and this is why
geography,
I'm a good pub quiz team manager.
Well.
No, I'm not bad on geography, but I am better at organising a pub quiz team and knowing who to have for what categories.
Science and nature, I'm quite bad on in Trivial Pursuit. All the rest, I'm fine on.
I haven't played Trivial Pursuit for years, you know. That's something that I could do this Christmas.
I'm like a sponge when it comes to things that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
But if I was interested in biology or geography, I'd have been brilliant in school. But I was interested in reading Empire magazine. And it just all goes in. But I've got no useful thing. So on a pub quiz, it's just kind of like, where's the film? Film man's only 5 questions.
If me and Nick, sometimes Nick will say, oh, did you know this? And I go, I did know that because I also read it in a 1995 issue of Premiere. And it's just that.
Nowadays, you would have found each other probably with the internet and, you know, yes. You would have been the two big film geeks. But you were, it's just such a beautiful image of you two both being kind of, oh, why is there no one like me in the world? And then it's taken you all this time to find each other.
It was weird to
Did you have anyone else who was like you?
No, because people would think that if you were that interested in something, it was weird, you know. And I found, yeah, but I would, yeah,
I know. Well, I think that's the, this is why I love what you're doing, because I think great enthusiasms are, you know, it's I've always been someone who just wants to tell everyone about things I really love. And everyone was a bit too cool when I was growing up, and it was like, oh, don't be that girl who kind of goes, please listen to my music.
Well, I think that might be why you retain it, because you've got no one to share
it
with.
Yeah, that's true. I don't get it out of, you know.
It's just in there still like a pinball, smashing about until you've got someone going, oh, did you know that this happened?
I know, or someone asked me in a quiz. Because I also am really bad at remembering conversationally anything. But if I'm in a quiz situation and John Humphreys is staring me in the face, then I kind of go, oh!
With his eyes.
Yeah, with his slightly lascivious... I won't look at him the
with
same
his eyes
now.
And his erection.
Oh.
I really like The Man with Two Brains.
Yes.
I saw that again recently, and I never liked it as much. And then as a jerk, and then I saw it again recently, and I was just like, "Oh my god! Every single scene is a sketch,
and it's
a really clever pastiche." And I think that's what I really like is the Steve Martin persona.
Yeah.
And I think that there's so much pastiche going on in The Man with Two Brains that his persona doesn't really come out. It's not like Steve Martin. He's doing a performance. Mm. And I watched it again recently, and I just had a completely different... It was like, oh, my God, I've been watching it wrong all these years.
Yeah.
And the Carl Reiner films that he made, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid as well.
His character... How do you spell his character name in Man with Two Brains?
Is this one of your questions?
No, but I wouldn't be able to tell you, but I think it's HFF N. Is there an N in there even? RR? No, okay.
HFF. There's that little girl. There's a little girl, and he comes out and he gives her loads of really complicated instructions. Goes, repeat it, and then she just repeats it. She did it for real. She learnt it all, and she did it for real. They thought they were going to have to put it on boards, and people think that she could do it on boards, but she was like 5 years old, and so she couldn't read like to that standard.
Yeah.
It's HFUHRUHURR.
No ends at all. I'm way off.
I could see an N. But I think I've tried to remember it in the past.
Yeah.
That's because an H looks a little bit like an N with a hat on.
It does. It
is. It looks a bit like an enthusiastic N sticking its arm up because it knows the answer.
Yeah. Hey, I'm an N. Can I just talk about All of Me quickly, just because Lily Tomlin, I am obsessed with Lily Tomlin as well. And I think she's so, so good in that.
Yeah.
I think that's it, because Lily Tomlin wasn't a sort of figure to me growing up. Except she was in All of Me, and that was the only kind of reference.
And 9 to 5.
Oh God, 9 to 5.
No, but I didn't see 9 to 5 till much later.
Oh, really?
So I always thought of her like, where's she from? And she's sort of brilliant in this one film, and you go, she should be in other things. They should put her in something else. She's good in that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was such an unusual thing to see, like, an older, I mean, she wasn't even that old, but, you know, an older woman and an equal. And I just absolutely loved her persona in that movie well. You know, it just was something that I was really not used to seeing. It blew my mind.
They must have had to get together a bit like John Travolta and Nicolas Cage got together to work out.
Yeah, Face Off.
Face Off. The little character trips of, like, giving family members a spam in the face with their hands. That's what I do. I just whack my hand into movie. And they must have had to get together and work out what all their mannerisms were.
But I always think it's a bit of a shame with Steve Martin, because I think his films were so good up to a point, and he didn't really do much wrong footing until he just went, nah, go for broke now. He does a bit of, Robert De Niro now. It feels like people won't think of Robert De Niro as being good.
He's been bad longer than he was good.
I know.
I don't think that's the same as Steve Martin at all.
I think
there's
always
something to love in his performances, even if some of the films are terrible.
Oh, his films are shit, but I just don't go and see Steve Martin anymore.
Yeah.
He's got a decade or just over a decade of absolute badness.
Yes, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's a bit like Rob Reiner in that respect, where Rob Reiner had just such an amazing string of films. It doesn't really matter if Rob Reiner makes films anymore. Obviously, he wants to keep working. Steve Martin isn't interested in making films. He's interested in
modern art.
He's interested in modern art, playing the banjo. He writes short stories and novellas. He was the biggest stand-up comedian on the planet, which is why he wore a white suit so people could see him in stadiums. And he was the first sort of like rock star comedian, where he was just so huge. And then he got to a point, he was just like, well, I can't take this any further. And then he went, films, I'm going to do films. And so he started writing, he co-wrote The Jerk with Carl Reiner.
That's how that came about, wasn't it? That he wanted to take a year off touring, and so he was so tired that he thought, well, if I make a film, we can just send it out like a roadshow and have that, like,
yeah. And he did that short film before it, didn't he? He did Absent-Minded Waiter. And then, so he started doing that, and he was just like, this is brilliant. That does all the legwork for me. That's great. And then he got to a point, and he wrote Roxanne, and then he wrote L.A. Story. And that was kind of, I think, his crowning achievement, was to be like, great, I did those. And then he went, you know what, I'm going to take some time. I think he really loved A Simple Twist of Fate, and it did nothing at the box office. And he did that along the same time as Mixed Nuts, which were both not very good films. And then he went, right, okay, so he started writing theatre. So he did the theatre, he wrote a play, and he loved theatre. He's a multimillionaire, he doesn't ever have to work ever again. So he started writing theatre. Then he started writing books, then he wrote Bowfinger, which was, I think, him and Eddie Murphy's last great film. And then he started playing the banjo, and he's also a magician. He's got like, he's one of the most creative people on the planet, and he's got like 7 creative passions, and he's mastered all of them almost. And you just like go, anyone that turns around and says Steve Martin's not funny anymore, doesn't make funny films anymore, can go fuck themselves. I mean, I always say this. He said, like, he had 15 years. He had 15 years where he was making amazing films. Yeah, and the reason why he's not making amazing films anymore is because it's easier to say, I'll do the Pink Panther, but I'll rewrite it. Then if you're going to make it anyway, I'll do it and I'll rewrite it.
It feels like, oh, this should be better.
Oh, of course it should be better, but it wasn't a passion project. Who wants to do a remake of The Pink Panther? No. Also, you're going into it going, it's already done. Peter Sellers has already done it.
Yeah.
People have tried to reboot it before. With Robert Benigni, was son of Pink Panther, and someone else played him. Someone weird. It wasn't Carl Reiner. It was like Carl Reiner. It was Alan Arkin.
Alan Arkin did it first, didn't he? Or was that's quite early on, I think.
No, I think that because the Inspector Pink Clouseau. Panther was the David Niven film.
Yes.
And he was like a little walk-on cameo, wasn't he?
Yes.
Inspector
Clouseau. Yeah.
He was like a background character. Who stole the show? And then what?
Shot in
the Dark is the one, because I remember I got the box set of VHSs and being really furious that A Shot in the Dark was in that box set. That,
why?
You know, just felt like, well, it wasn't
a Pink Panther film.
Yeah,
it was an Inspector Clouseau film. I remember we were all fascinated with A Shot in the Dark. There's a bit when his trousers come down and someone at school swore blind you could see his willy.
It's like someone had the Barbara Windsor top flying off
bit
that everyone when VHS came in, that was the sole purpose of VHS was to see if you could see a knocker.
That and the leg crossing scene from Base Instinct.
Yes, both God, of,
what VHS have you got, Nick? I've got Carry On Camping and Basic Instinct, and they're both absolutely worn out. So I think that you can, Steve Martin has a free pass with me, and any time he does anything,
I think he's brilliant.
Any time he does anything good. It's always a success.
Yeah. Bill Murray is a similar kind of, you know, he can do some...
I think he's a lot more hit and miss.
Yeah.
In terms of... I think when he's good, he's absolutely amazing. Mm. And then he'll be doing stuff like Larger Than Life, where you just like go, nah. And I think that he's much more inconsistent in the 80s than Steve Martin was. Sure. It was like, Steve Martin elevated everything. His bit in... I mean, Little Shop of Horrors is an amazing film.
Well, that's the thing.
But his bit in Little Shop of Horrors is just like, fucking make the whole film about him.
Yeah. That's I was going to mention that. I'm not as big a fan of Little Shop of Horrors as a lot of people are, but I think that bit was the thing.
Yeah.
That was probably my Basic Instinct. I used to rewind that and play that back.
It was so
and
cool.
I just rewind that 5 minutes and play it again and again. And I remember it being one of those things that, when you don't actually laugh that much at things, I remember watching it and being in tears and then rewinding it and just crying, laughing.
You know, I didn't watch the leg crossing scene over and over again because I found it funny.
It's pretty funny.
I was masturbating, Nathaniel.
So was I.
I've got to play the dentist in a school play. And I fucking, it was like... dream come true. I got to finally be Steve Martin in Little Shop of Horrors. Yeah. He's so cool in that film. I've got that on vinyl, of the single of that, the dentist single.
I would say, I really do love Steve Martin. I think partly it's that if I could go back in time, I wouldn't see Bringing Down the House. I just wouldn't. I wouldn't go.
I haven't seen
it. It made me really sad.
House,
don't ever see it.
Bringing Down the House, yeah, sure. But it
made me really sad.
I think he was one of the best Oscar hosts as well. I still remember the joke that he did. It was 2001. It was the year Gladiator came out. And he said, a lot of people are talking about violence in the movies. And I agree. I took a 15-year-old boy to see Gladiator, and he cried all the way through it. Plus, he didn't know who I was. And it was like, he said that at the Oscars. It was such a great joke. And you go, fucking hell.
No, he's great. I mean, I do love him.
And his 30 Rock little appearances,
yes.
Very good.
That's it, because when you see him do something like that, it makes you kind of... yearn for it.
Exactly.
And you go, oh,
please, some more.
And it was like I remember when he joined Twitter, just being really funny on that and things, and just being this kind of, oh, great, he's still beacon. It's like, I respect it. He doesn't have to do it. He's not a performing monkey. He doesn't have to do what I want him to do.
He's done enough, Nathaniel.
He's earned it. But then I'd almost rather he didn't make any films.
Yeah, but I think that he just wants to... I mean, what was the good year? Was that the one with him, Jack Black, and Owen Wilson bird watching? And it's called A Big Year. Uh-huh. And fuck me, that's a boring film. I watched it on the plane, and you go, it's a waste of Steve Martin and Owen Wilson's talents. Jack Black's just fine.
I love a plane. I've just been on a plane, and I never go to the movies anymore, and I'm terrible for not doing it. But I watched a... what's her name? Melissa McCarthy. She goes back to college and her daughter's at college. And it's the kind of movie that you think, if I wasn't on a plane, I would be furious that I'd watch this. But because I was on a plane, I bloody loved it. And I was like, oh, I've got a really nice, warm feeling about this
film. Did you cry?
No, I didn't. But I felt there were some amazing things about it, because there was, you know, they didn't do a love interest.
Life of the Party, it's called.
Life of the Party, thank you very much. Yeah, and it's not a good film by any measure, but she's very good in it, and they did some really nice... It just felt like it's a very now film, because there were a lot of sort of sexist clichés they could have fallen into that they didn't, and it obviously had that sense of bloody hell, Hollywood is now going, she doesn't have to end up with a guy, and the women don't all need to be bitchy, and it was about sort of, girls at college, but they're not cows to each other, and it's not, it was just interesting.
Well, I think that I haven't seen that film, but I think there is a value to that people don't talk about now, just to have, like, there should be enough films that you only really ever need to watch once that you enjoy.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter.
Not
if you go, I'm not going to watch it for the rest of my life. But if you enjoy it, it's like most of these films that we talk about are things that no one really expected people to watch more than once.
Yeah. Well, comedy is always, I mean, especially sort of, because I loved a rom-com because that was what I was fed as a, you know, as a teenage girl. They go, this is for you. And there are actually a lot of really good rom-coms that you go, they're never going to be critically acclaimed or revered or remembered, but they were so lovely for, you know, for me as a as a young person. I really enjoyed them.
Yeah, I mean, I love romantic comedies, but I do think that the people have forgotten how to make them.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Nora Ephron was a great loss.
When you get to when you get something like 27 Dresses, which is an absolute piece of shit film.
I've never seen it.
Fuck me, you're just like, what is this? And even the Hugh Grant films that he was making later on, you go, nah, they've got all the ingredients, but it's wrong. You know, we're talking about 2 weeks' notice. We're talking about
2 weeks' notice was awful.
Yeah, but it was like we've got the formula. We've got the formula, which is we'll get Hugh Grant plus Andy McDowell plus Julia Roberts plus Sandra Bullock plus Sarah Jessica Parker, and then you get Hugh Grant with an American woman, and that's the formula. And then you go, yeah, but they're shit, aren't they? They're really shit.
Can I tell you about my favourite ever film?
Yeah.
It's not, but I'm saying that just for now. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Oh, yeah.
That is that's a movie that, again, I think I watched it really late on. I had no interest in it because I sort of thought I knew what it was about. And I had a flatmate who loved it, and it literally saved her life because she was on the verge of taking her own life, and she went to see it, and it kind of lifted her out of that moment. And so she made me watch it, and I have loved it ever since.
I'm not sure it's such a
wonderful film. No, it's great. It's a Howard Hawks movie.
Yeah.
It got made tons of...
I went to see Bringing Up Baby last week.
Fucking
hell.
Amazing.
That's an absolute... Cary Grant.
Amazing.
It's fucking incredible. And Catherine Hepburn. But Cary Grant is incredible in that film.
Cary Grant, I did... There's a Radio 4 programme called Great Lives where you go on and you talk about a great life. And they asked me to do it. And I always thought, it's you choose who you want to do, right? Mm-hmm. But they phoned me up and they said, because I'd presented a thing at the Cary Grant Festival in Bristol. They have a Cary Grant Festival every 2 years. And I'd done a thing, and I love Cary Grant, and so they said, would you do it? And I was like, yeah, that's great. But what I realised when I came to do it was that I love the films of Cary Grant, but I didn't really know much about his life. And so I read his autobiography and I thought, oh, that'll be fine. I didn't have much time, I was quite busy, and I went along to do it. And Matthew Paris, who presents it, said, you know, we've got some guy who's written a biography called Haunted Idol. And I was like, oh, that sounds a bit dark. And we started the programme, and Matthew Paris went, right, so Lucy, as a female and, you know, self-proclaimed feminist, it's quite interesting that you chose the violent misogynist and wife beater Cary Grant.
Absolutely hung out for dry.
And I was like, oh my, and I had to stop the recording. I said, listen, I'm really sorry, I only read his autobiography. I didn't actually read any biographies.
I like to see it from his point of view, thanks.
So, I mean, talk about teaching you a lesson and doing your research. But yeah, I love his films, but yeah, by all accounts, a bit of a, you know, a troubled character.
Very troubled,
shall we
man.
Say.
Very troubled man.
We've got to do the game.
We've got to do the game.
This, you might like this, but you might also hate it, because it's a quiz entirely based on my own opinion, where you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before it.
Starting
with Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah.
Is Taylor Swift better or worse than Kenneth Branagh?
Oh, man. What? I mean, he was such a figure of hate when I was like, you know, because everyone hated him because he was a brilliant actor, but posh. I think, well, I mean, he is a great actor, but I'm going to say Taylor Swift is better.
I'm going to say Kenneth Branagh, because I don't know much about
Taylor Swift. Right, fine. I mean, Taylor Swift is...
I don't know. I think Taylor Swift... Oh, we haven't got time to debate it. Taylor Swift's better than Kenneth Branagh.
Richard Burton. Is Richard Burton better or worse than Taylor Swift?
Better. Worse.
I'm going to say better. Again, I don't know. John Bon Jovi, better
like
or worse?
I like Taylor Swift a lot more. No, John Bon Jovi.
But Richard Burton, worse.
I mean, yeah, I'd have to say
worse. Worse, he is worse,
but, yeah. You know, that's
nothing. Richard Harris, is Richard Harris better or worse than John Bon Jovi?
Better.
Better,
he's
yeah,
done the wild geese there,
haven't
we?
Is
Roger Moore coming
up? Not yet, no. Is Morrissey better or worse than Richard Harris?
Oh, God, well, I mean, worse. I would have said better for most of my life.
Is Roger Moore better or worse than Morrissey?
Is Christopher Lee better or worse than Morrissey?
Better.
Better, he is better. Is Cameron Diaz better or worse than Christopher Lee?
Worse. Worse, it's Christopher Lee.
Come on, I mean, I know, but you know, I just feel
Lee.
Like I should
she can be a high card.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Bearing
yeah.
in mind, it's my own opinion.
Oh,
yeah,
well, I think you like Cameron Diaz.
I do.
Not more than Christopher Lee.
Not more than Christopher
no,
Lee.
Actually, God.
Did you hear him banging on about Hammer earlier?
Dionne Warwick. Is Dionne Warwick better or worse than Cameron Diaz?
Dionne Warwick is better than almost anyone in the world.
Better. And is Tom Hardy better or worse than Dionne Warwick?
I'm afraid he's worse.
Don't be afraid.
Despite playing Nick in that film.
He's going to win an Oscar when he's me.
What's the score?
What was the score?
Six.
Not a bad score.
Not a bad score.
Not a great score.
I mean, I am very competitive, but...
Well, you share it with Colin Holt, Andy Kindler, Marek Lawood, Richard Sandling, Mark Simmons and David
I'm
Trent.
I'm happy with all of them as company,
that's not
really.
So, it's not so great, but it's not
oh,
so
yeah,
bad.
Oh, yeah, Sam did do badly.
Yeah, three.
John Niven, very good, very 10. Mm.
And we should say, Fingers on Buzzers is available...
Everywhere. Just... It's there. It's out and about.
Someone will shout it at you if you're not got your headphones.
Fingers on buzzers. Yeah.
Did you manage to download that Noel Edmonds rave song?
Oh, it's on the thing.
What's it called? Candice Cat. Oh my God, he's named it after his sex doll.
I'm going to have to put the headphones on now.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Okay, right. Well, thank you for
thank
listening,
you for
guys.
Coming, Lucy.
Oh,
thank you for
thanks.
Having us.
Thanks for coming in, Lucy.
Absolute pleasure.
It was lovely to chat to you, and we didn't really talk that much, so please come back again another day.
I like some other things.
And I felt like we could have talked a lot more about
I felt
Dave
Noel
Martin.
Edmonds took up a little bit too much of the time that we had.
We should get him
already.
In.
Yeah.
Jake will come
oh,
in.
He'll be in touch. Yeah. Don't worry about that. He'll be in touch.
Punch that like button and hit subscribe. That was Fan Club.
May I ask you a question?
You can ask me the question.
Are you ready? Are you ready for the question?
You can ask me the question. Oh, I hope it's a big one. Oh my God. I'm ready for the question.
What's in your box?